Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is the New Books Network. We are joined today by Joseph E. David. He is a professor of law at Sapir Academic College in Israel and a visiting professor at the program in Judaic Studies and Law School at the University of Yale. His research focuses on Jewish studies, law and religion, legal history, and comparative jurisprudence. And he is joining us today to talk about his latest book entitled Kinship, Law, and Politics, An Anatomy of Belonging. Joseph, thanks so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
So this is a book that grapples with what may be somewhat a familiar concept, the sense of belonging. But as you develop the discussion of what it means or has meant historically, it becomes more complex. So let's try to address from the beginning, grapple with this notion of what does it mean to belong?
Oh, well, that's a big question. I was trying to grapple with it. I was trying to really sort out what does it mean to belong and what belonging is about. Well, it came first from my, I guess, personal concerns, which intrigued my intellectual curiosities. I guess that belong, what does it mean to belong? It means that the other way around, being alone or solitude is not a satisfying circumstance for us. We cannot go in terms with being alone. Being alone is perceived as a problem. And therefore, belonging is in many ways an answer, a response to our existential experience of being alone.
And so you describe this partly with reference to, even though this is, you delve into the ancient history of the concept of belonging, you make reference to modern psychological science in terms of the evidence that's needed in order to support the idea that we really do have a natural state of belonging or our natural sociability, right?
Right. You know, we used to think about belonging as one of the fundamental needs of every human being. And indeed, it is one of the needs. But it is much more than, you know, it's even before psychology became a science or a realm of knowledge. And before we observed it as a need, we see various attempts to either explain to what we belong and what does it mean to belong, and also to define the framework to which we belong. So if it is on the very preliminary level of family and kinship, the question is, what does it mean to belong to a family and what does it mean to be out of the family? How do you join a family? How do you becoming part of it? So I think mainly in English, the term belonging, which is composed of being and longing, encapsulates part of the very core meaning of belonging. It is something that we are seeking. It is something that we are longing to. It is something that it is not natural for us to be at. So we have to reaffirm our belonging and to be sure that we belong to any framework and we still belong to that.
So you use that word natural. There is this distinction that seems has cropped up over time. You go all the way back to the ancient Greek notions of belonging, where they conceive of people as being part of some kind of, in a way, maybe a seamless whole within society, that is something that's not necessarily chosen. It's not a, maybe not even be something that's a conscious facet of one's psychological makeup, but rather it's simply a natural state that you find yourself in. Is that right?
Yeah. The idea of pre-existing unity that belonging is about. So belonging is about reconstructing this pre-existing unity, which appears, by the way, at the same time in the biblical literature, with the idea of, you know, Adam and Eve being initially part of the very same united entity or corpus. This is one way to explain belonging. In a natural way. And this kind of explanation was very dominant in either post-biblical or post-Hellenic traditions alike. But, you know, at some point, well, perhaps one of the landmarks for this history is Ibn Khaldun, the 14th century Arab thinker, sociologist, we could say, but obviously a brilliant intellectual, where he defined belonging as some illusion, some constructive illusion that we have to create ourselves. So he maybe expressed the idea that it is not necessarily something neutral. And the fact that for many ages and with a long history, we were trying to explain belonging in natural terms also indicate how crucial and how fundamental belonging was for the human history. It was something that we were not willing to accept other answers rather than some unnatural answer. I think once we think about belonging as something which is cultural constructed, which is something that is invented by human being, something that had to do with the conscience. And when Ibn Khaldun says it's a very functional and constructive illusion, there is something that deliberating with this idea. So we don't look for the natural basis for belonging. We could understand that the natural need for belonging, it is indeed there. It is a natural need. But nevertheless, the answer of belonging is not so natural anymore. So the asymmetry between the naturalness of the problem and the fact that the answer is not necessarily natural, it's not something essential, rather something that is changeable and it is dependent on our decisions and about our contingent history, I think helps us to understand more comprehensively that belonging is coming from an existential concern, but the answer varies and they are not necessarily natural, and therefore we could also develop more and on various levels of answers of belonging.
So the way we've discussed it so far, these are rather abstract concepts. There's the notion of belonging that may be a quote-unquote natural, objective condition for individuals. But then, as you noted, there's the medieval distinction made by Ibn Khaldun regarding it being kind of what we today would call a social construct or an imaginary or artificial kind of condition. But you also talk about the notion of belonging in very concrete terms, in terms of how it actually organizes and affects people's lives across or through different societies. You pick particular societies, especially in the Mediterranean, but you talk about family relations or family status. What does it mean to be part of a family? Also, what are the legal obligations within a given society? And in modern times, and we'll get to this later, of course, we'll talk about the political ramifications of this. So let's talk about, let's start with family, for example. How are the different notions of belonging actually going to impact families and family structure?
Yeah, well, actually, from the very first, phases of you know, science of sociology and the like, I think the search for the basics of belongings went to families or incest relations, because family, you know, it is exactly where we are thinking about the natural basis for some affinity and connectedness, and we also see where culture comes in and shapes the idea of belonging. Obviously, family ties are perhaps the litmus paper where to look at belonging ties and the like. I remember one of the first texts which struck me about belonging was the ancient Roman law about adoption. And adoption, that's in a legal institution, the Roman law was defined as an imitation of nature. Rather, it is about creating relations between parent and a child, but not in a natural way, but by imitating nature. So the Roman, the law says, adaptionem naturam imitatur. And when St. Thomas later on refers to this idea, so he explains it by referring to the way that Aristotle defines arts. And the idea of art as imitating the natural existing, as imitating natural forms or natural entities, the Greek ideas of aesthetics, was taken by St. Thomas to explain that we are imitating nature where nature fails. So, we couldn't breed and procreate. Therefore, we have these legal tools to imitate nature and, in fact, to fix, overcome the failures of nature and to create, artificial ways of belonging. So, family structures all through the way of the Western history is about a mixture of natural bases and some artificial or cultural institutions. So marriage is obviously something that we are creating a connection that was not first existing in nature, but we treat it as a natural connection. And therefore, the grappling with the definition of family, and obviously incest laws is the place to look at it, because incest laws is about belonging in the sense that when you define who is it prohibited to sleep with and who are you allowed to sleep with, is about really drawing the line of belonging, who is in and who is out. So I was very excited with various legal regulations of incest, and mainly at the points where there were changes in the legal material, when there were some legal changes or legal reforms, changing perspectives about legal regulations of incestual relations. And I found it exciting moments of grappling with belonging. And they didn't use the terms that we use nowadays, the belongings and affinity and so on. So they used obviously the traditional technical legal terms, but it was exactly about belonging. How do we see the framework of belonging? What does it mean to belong? And in some of the chapters in my book, I was really fascinating for me to realize that what was at stake for the jurists when they modifying these regulations, it is about how to define anew the frameworks of belonging or how to rearticulate the idea of kinship. What does it mean to be in kin ties?
And so in order to explain how this occurred or the debates occurred in real time, you refer to, in particular, Jewish history and the Karaite sect within Judaism. Can you explain that role in particular and how that helps develop your ideas of how belonging impacted people's understandings of their place in the world?
Yeah, let me just say a few words about the Karaites, because they're not that known, you know, apart from academic circles. The Karaites were actually a marginal sect. And in fact, we know that it was not only one sect. It was there were various sects which opposed the Rabbinite to mainstream traditional Judaism. And most of them shared the premises that they rejected the Talmudic tradition, and they rejected tradition as an unquestionable source of knowledge. So they were skeptic, you know, they were skeptic about even their own tradition. They checked and rechecked all the time their traditions, and they were very suspicious that, you know, they got it wrong. They might have got it wrong. And then I came across this 11th century legal reform. You know, we talk a lot about the theories of legal reforms, and this was a legal reform, a halachic legal reform, that was hardly studied in the modern scholarship. And we have, it is a reform that is documented, and most of the documents are still existing in the archives. The manuscripts were mainly held in the St. Petersburg libraries, so there was no access for Western scholars for many years. But now we have access, and we have a chance to examine this legal reform. And the more I studied this complicated text, you know, it was not only about deciphering the Arabic, the Judeo-Arabic, the medieval, very, very difficult Hebrew scriptures, but it was also to understand their calculations about the degrees of relatives and the like. And the more I digged into that, I realized that this reform was about realizing that some set of ideas that explained kinship were not valid anymore. And they accused their rabbis, their tradition, their traditional authorities, that they got it wrong, what kinship is about. And they were trying to propose a different conceptions of what kinship is about, and accordingly to change the legal regulations. So it was really something serious. It was not only about reducing the degrees of relatives that you are allowed to marry. It was about developing a totally different scope and view about what kinship is about and what does it mean to belong to kinship. So I found this reform exciting. I was digging in archives. I found wonderful manuscripts, unstudied manuscripts, and then I realized again and again it was about belonging. It was not just about, you know, legal rhetoric. It was not just about intellectual acrobatic of how to interpret principles and how you could play with them. It was something much deeper. It was about coming up with new perspective about belonging.
So can you explain more specifically how the Karaites saw belonging in distinction or in contrast to the Rabbinite view?
Yeah. Well, in a nutshell, the previous idea of belonging was that kinship is about selfness. To belong to a kinship, to belong to a family, to be part of a family, namely, it was meant to be part, to take part of the same selfness. And it was based on the scriptural ideas of, obviously, the core idea is the verse in Genesis that, you know, the Adam and Eve, when they united, they became one united flesh. So the two became one, right? And it was interpreted in the very same way that it was interpreted in the church history. that, you know, they were either meant to be together and this tie is not to be dissolved. But the Karaite made the emphasis on the spiritual aspect of this unification. Namely, they said that, you know, when once a man and a woman are united, they become one flesh, and not only one flesh, but also one spirit. And in fact, they use the Arabic term nafs, which is not only the spirit or the soul, it's about the self. So they became one self. And this idea, when they thought about it legally, it had enormous implementations. For example, so in the very same way the canon law approached marriage, they also understood that once a man and a woman are, you know, coupled, they're united, they become one entity, one self. But, you know, since they allow divorce, or, you know, in the case of being widowed, they ask what happens if one of the couple, you know, say, for example, the woman was married again to another person. What are the relations between the second husband and the first husband? And they said, you know, they're obviously part of the same self. And its legal implementation was that the sister of the second husband was considered legally as the sister of the first husband. And she was prohibited to marry the first husband. And so on and so forth. Namely, it was extended, presumably with no cutting edge, because they had this idea about the self that it is extended in a very contagious way. And they used the metaphor of being not only being polited, but even transmitting the selfness as a disease. So, you know, the idea was also termed in the other tradition, which took it in the very same way, through the term contagio carnalis. Namely, there is something that is transmitted through corporeal union, and they pointed out that it is about the selfness. So basically, belonging was to take part in the very same self. Now, the reform was about dismantling this idea of kinship and belonging and providing a new definition of what does it mean to belong to. And they came out with the idea, we could nowadays think about it in terms of network. To belong to something means to be part of a network rather to be part of the self. Namely, that you have some structural relations between the relatives without determining that they are part of the very same self. So you could describe the kinship of the family in structural terms as a family tree. As a family, you know, they had other metaphors. But they are all structural conceptions rather than something more essential as selfness.
So did this allow for greater intermarriage, or in other words, was this reform in conceiving what was structural versus quote unquote natural, perhaps, did that allow for broader notions of what was permitted, or more permissiveness in regard to who one could marry?
Yes, indeed. So obviously the first impact was much more individuals were permitted to marry each other. But it was not all. This was not the main thing, because some scholars who approached it thought that was the main motive for this reform. And indeed, the very same motive motivated the Canon 50 of the 1215 Lutheran convention, which also reduced the degrees of prohibited relatives to be married. But this was, in Canon 50, we know quite sure that they had concern about the fact that people, you know, couldn't marry too many individuals around there. So they had some urge to reduce this prohibition. But this is not the case with the Karaites. We have no evidences that, that there was some social concerns that, you know, they couldn't marry much of their relatives. And I think it was something deeper. It was about how to understand relatedness. So, for example, once you think about kinship in terms, in structural terms, you also define siblings differently. So siblings were concerned, you know, followed that reform as less relatives than parents, for example. Siblings were concerned relatives only in the sense that they shared the same parents, but not as being part of the same self. So I guess it did affect their emotional framework. That did affect their attitudes. Indeed, it did allow them to marry much more individuals, but this is not the main thing. And I don't think that they were urged by that, and I don't think that this was all about. They wouldn't made so many efforts, and they wrote, you know, they wrote dozens of books about it, if it was only about about allowing much more individuals to marry each other. It was something even deeper, I would argue.
So how historically successful were the Karaite moves to reform?
Well, first, we could definitely say that they succeeded in the sense that most of the Karaites followed that reform. Indeed, we know about an attempt in the 16th century to revive the previous perception. But that attempt didn't succeed. You know, it is also well documented, but we don't know followers of that. There are not many followers of that attempt. So on a practical level, they did succeed. But I think it's more than that. I think in general, the same move from essential understanding of kinship to a structural one is not unique to the Karaite tradition. In many ways, you could also trace that shift in other Western, you know, Western Latin context. And this is the point where kinship was portrayed through family trees rather than images of a body, of a corpus, and alike. And did affect also the general Western history of ideas, but not in the same sharp way that it occurred in the Karaite tradition. Because for them, it was not, you know, a natural evolution of the concept. It was a point where they rejected their traditional perception. They claimed it to be wrong. And this is also something very unique about the Karaites. They were not obliged or committed to a tradition. Therefore, it was a radical change, I would say, or radical legal reform, in the sense that they could blame the previous authorities to be wrong. And they just got it wrong. They just understood the scriptures in a wrong way. And they offered a new reading in the scriptures and new definitions. So the move from natural or essential perception of kinship towards a structural one, I think we could see that in many other traditions, in many other points through the history, not in a very sharp move as we see it in the Karaite case. And the Karaite case is radical because it's you know, it's like a U-turn. It's like, you know, claiming, you know, it was totally wrong. We have to wake up and still remain within the Karaite tradition and Karaite legal readings, but to understand the very basic concept differently.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, it's interesting you note, though, that even though the marriage opportunities were not the main concern of the reform, it does seem to me, and maybe I want to make sure I'm getting this historically correct, that the Karaite reform produces greater choice and more breadth and opportunities for intermarriage or marriage opportunities among different previously forbidden marital relations or familial relations, whereas at the same time, or roughly at the same time in the Middle Ages, especially the early Middle Ages all the way through in the Christian church, you're having a restriction on marital opportunities. In other words, the reform in the Christian church seems to be tightening who you can marry, whereas the Karaite reform is trying to broaden, even though that may not be the main concern or objective. Is that right?
Well, to be more precise, the later Christian reform and the reform in the church was also much more broadening the opportunities to move. But in that case, we know that they were troubled by social concerns. So it is a totally different reform. The first scholars who looked at the Karaite reform indeed were trying to explain the Karaite reform in terms of the Canon 50. Because that was, you know, the very famous case that they knew, and they knew all the contextual details that it was about social concerns. So they applied it to the Karaite case. But, you know, that may be the differences between a legal historian which is interested in the intellectual history and legal historian who is interested in the social or economic history. I learned that, you know, I presumed that it was also about some social concerns. But the more I read the text, I found no evidence that there were any social concerns about extending the permitted individuals to be married. On the other hand, they were much more concerned about conceptions and ideas. So maybe I'm putting two emphases about concepts and ideas because of my inclinations toward that. But again, you know, in this case, you find no practical evidence to social concerns. On the other hand, you find the huge urges as a matter of legal definition and intellectual understanding of kinship. I would make the difference between the church reform and the Karaite reform in the sense that it was not only about the different motives that they had, but it was also about being troubled by different barriers or different burdens. Once it is only a social concerns, you know, you had just have to find the authority to make these changes if you are convinced that these changes are justified and are needed. But once it is about, you know, an accurate understanding of the scriptures and accurate understandings of what belonging is, then you need to recruit different arms and use different faculties and different argumentations. So it's in many ways different reform, even though the consequences are alike.
So we've been talking about the period of reform in the Middle Ages in the Christian church versus in Jewish law regarding the family. Let's fast forward to another area that you discuss, which is in the modern period, in particular in the 17th century, in a debate between the English political theorists, Robert Filmer and John Locke. Mm-hmm. So You talk about their conceptions of the family and how it relates to political order. And so let's explain that debate.
Yeah. Well, again, this is one of the cases which, you know, everyone knows, everyone, you know, this famous text where Locke is arguing with Thorbert Fillmore. But when I studied this as a young student, I was taught that this was about, you know, monarchy and, you know, it was liberal ideas. There's this justification for the monarchy. And the more I read Locke deeply, I understood that he was troubled much more with his, you know, the coherency of his liberal ideas, and not only with either justifying or objecting monarchy. And therefore I realized that he was concerned about, I would say, the epistemological backdrop of the idea of political authority, political privileges, and so you know, they argued about what does it mean, what's the meaning of the political authority, and you know, the traditional monarch answer was that political authority or political power is some kind of manifestation of the natural authority, the parental authority that is established in the family framework, and it was only extended to the political realm. So it was basically, you know, phenomenologically, it was the very same relations, the very same idea of authority. And when John Locke was trying to develop the liberal ideas of the political realm, he had to answer that too. What are the sources of the political authority? And he came up with the answer that separates the family and the political as two distinct realms. But more than that, he also defined anew the idea of parental authority or the parental power. So in many ways, it was awakening from the old ancient fundamentals of the parental power in the Roman family, the power of the household that is all at the hands of the father. And what does it mean to have the power over your household? And what does it mean if you are liberal to have a parental power or parental authority towards the individuals as the members of the family? And I was struck, I remember, by Locke's definition of the parental authority in terms of what was it? He used the metaphor of stippling clothes, something like that. Something that is instrumental and functional. And the first thing I thought at that time is whether John Locke had kids at all. I was a young father at that time, and it was striking for me to think about my parenthood as something moral, mental, and functional, that I'm only being a parent until my son is independent and is you know, it doesn't need my assistance anymore. And therefore, I think that their argument was about how to understand first and foremost parental power, parental authority. And once you have a different attitudes towards that, you also come to the political realm with a different starting point, with a different background to start discussing what political authority is about.
It is, it's my recollection that Locke did not marry and had no children, as far as we know.
Well, I thought he had some illegal, I'm not sure about that either, but anyhow, that was a point to be really contemplating about what drives a person to come to such a radical definition, which is, you know, it is challenging intellectually.
And of course, Locke and Filmer are both rooting their arguments in biblical interpretation.
Yes, indeed.
And so, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No. Well, yeah. So that was another thing which struck me, because I was just interested in exegesis and how people take the scriptures to such different ways. So, and it was one of these cases, you know, when they had totally different readings of the situation in heaven, you know. So while Filmer understood Adam as the prime archetype, paradigmatic idea of being a parent, you know, a parent, you know, that was endowed to be a parent by God, and that was endowed by the power to be a parent and to control and have a power upon his successors, Locke had a totally different interpretation and maybe a totally different experience of what does it mean to be the sole and first person in the human history. He had he understood Adam as an orphan rather than a parent. And I think it's a very core existential idea of the individuality. And, you know, individuality in Locke's liberalism is about being an individual with no power upon you. And if there is a need to be under some power, it's only instrumental, it's in only on your behalf, it's only as long as it serves your interests. So, this is a totally different approach, the very same literary description of the situation. And going back to where we started before, you know, the Bible describes Adam also carrying the problem of being alone. That's why God, you know, God was upset about creating him as a solitude creature. And he was trying to fix that by, you know, first introducing the other animals, and then when it didn't work, he created the female. And then he said, okay. But the very same, you know, primordial situation of being solitude was experienced and interpreted by these two thinkers so differently. And that was a launching point to totally diametric political views about political power.
And that's what you go on to describe, which is this, as you see it, turning point in the development of notions, personal notions of belonging in regard to the family, but also the role of the family within politics in the Western world, and the development of liberalism, the notions of individualism and consent, which is so famously associated with Locke, really has sprouted new notions of how should the law treat or regard the family, whether it's extended or in a nuclear family, as we call it today. You talk about this distinction between paternalistic views of the family versus organic and apolitical views. Can you explain those three different areas?
I guess what I was trying also to, in many ways, to come close to the grappling with the very same challenge by Christian theologians in the past few generations. And, you know, the endowers of the church and the Holy See. So, you know, I'm talking about John Paul II mainly, but to define the need and the justification for the family in terms of common good and in terms of a place where politics reaches and stops. So the family as an apolitical realm. I guess nowadays, perhaps I should insert into that the concept of privacy, which we are, you know, this is one of the things that actually came out from this study. I'm much more aware of the problem of privacy, private realm nowadays, not only because it is a hot topic in legal theory, but because I do think that it it is another concept which I would place next to belonging and identity. It is a concept through which we understand ourselves. And Locke was also, by stressing and re-stressing the distinction between the private and the public realm, is also placing privacy or the definition of primacy vis-a-vis the public and publicity as crucial to the liberal theory. And I think this is the question of the place of the family in the liberal society. And by the idea of defining the family as apolitical, I would say an apolitical island within the politics, within the overwhelming politics. So everything is political, but the family is a place which is pretend to be apolitical in many ways. So some of the standards that are applicable in the political realm are not necessarily applicable in the family realm. So, for example, while we cannot tolerate inequality in the political realm, we think that inequality within the family is not something that it's intolerable. It's something that it is a private issue to the same family. So maybe we could object it. Maybe we could be troubled by that. But it is, we treat it differently. We don't feel the same urge to intervene in inequality within the family. I'm not talking about something which is insulting and something that is depressing, but inequalities in the sense that you don't treat your children equally in the same that you treat individuals in your workplace in the same. You find a way to treat your children in the right way that you think that it is deserved, but not necessarily in the same way that it is expected in the public realm. So, but by this, I was trying to say that might be a source of justification for the political meaning of the family in a liberal society. A family is a place where you could escape political urges and political standards. A family is a place where it's not only a refuge, but it is a place that you could experience different standards. You could experience, other principles that you could not allow yourself to experience, by the way, in the political realm. And in that way, the private family and the public liberal society have some interplay between them, because the political realms needs these apolitical experiences. Apolitical experience is important to be trained for the political life and also to escape the political lives and to be more precise of what are you expected to behave like in the political realm and what are you expected elsewhere. So this was the kind of idea that I was trying to develop based on the liberal seeds of Locke and others, that the family is justified and it is important because perhaps the family is one of the very few paradigmatic manifestations of a private realm, of a privacy. Not only that the state should act for the benefits of the individual, the private individuals, but they should also allow their privacy, which is not political. Do I make any sense to you?
Yes, but it seems, as you acknowledge, that in the modern West, in the United States in particular, I can think of many or several examples of where this concern with the concern that is brought to the fore in the liberal context, the liberalism that we've inherited from Locke and other thinkers in regard to individualism and the ability to consent to one's role in society or one's place in society. In one sense, it's liberating, so to speak, from the traditionalism of Filmer. But on the other hand, it also invites or provides the basis for which the state can penetrate that area of privacy. And no longer is the family then apolitical, but it's rather an opportunity to try to correct perceptions of imbalance or inequality. And so, for example, legally in the United States, we've abolished interspousal tort immunity. You can now sue your spouse. That unity of personhood that was an inheritance from the traditional biblical understanding of marriage is no longer applicable in the United States. And so, and then, of course, you have the state's responsibilities, or at least the state's potential for taking on responsibilities regarding education of children, et cetera. And you refer to some of these. And so it seems a double-edged sword for liberalism, as you rightly, I think, rightly identify. Liberalism may be the breakpoint or the watershed event historically, because on the one hand, it allows for a separation and a distinction between the family structure and the way it functions versus the way the larger political state functions. But on the other hand, that larger political state can turn around and try to mold the family in its image, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We agree with you. And you put it in very, you know, perhaps in a better way than I did it before. Again, it is very tricky in the sense that obviously we should take seriously the state's responsibility and its capacity to intervene and to regulate and even to educate individuals within the family and to obviously to instruct and you know to see how things are developing from there. You know, everything starts at home, indeed. Nevertheless, I think that claiming that everything is political and is also troubling. Think about privacy nowadays. You know, our concerns nowadays be with privacy, which perhaps might be the new front for battling the borderlines of the political and the private realm. You know, there are so many advantages in the fact that, you know, advanced AI technologies can read my preferences and tell me and instruct me and lead me to my preferences, you know. So the private advertisement, it's a wonderful thing. And by the way, in other places in the world, they think it's brilliant and they bless it and celebrate it. And I'm also celebrating that, you know, because when I'm looking at something on the web, I'm very happy that I'm getting so many offers the other day. But I'm not so comfortable with the fact that my preferences are much more transparent to someone else, either a machine or some other individual, before I'm aware to that. So, you know, so intervening in our privacy, it's something very helpful. It's something very blessed in that sense. But we still need the capability to control these borderlines, or at least to have some illusion maybe that we control or have some control about our private life. Because this experience of controlling our private sphere, I think it is important for our behavior later on. So in that sense, I agree. If I sound like something that is justifying, you know, some injustices in family realms and with in blocking any intervention, so I was misunderstood and I did not explain myself correctly. Obviously, I mean, the intervention of the liberal state is totally justified and again, you know, and as we saw it in so many legal changes, mainly with regard to defining rape between married spouses and the like, I think it's totally justified. But I think, again, the experience of having a private realm where I control my preferences and I control my initiatives and ideas, I think it's a crucial experience for every individual before entering, not only chronologically, before entering the public sphere again. I think it is empowering the individual in the power sphere when he has experience in the private sphere as apolitical sphere.
The book is entitled Kinship, Law and Politics, An Anatomy of Belonging. And we've been joined today with its author, Joseph E. David. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much.